This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. 200,000. That's today's number. As of today, more than 200,000 people in the United States have died from the coronavirus. In Massachusetts, that number is 9,107 as of yesterday. We are still groping our way through this. Mixed messages of when a vaccine might become available, changing directives from the CDC on whether the virus is airborne, deep disagreements on when, where, and how it's safe to be together, which means it is time to ask more coronavirus questions. What do you need to know? Do you have questions about vaccines, ventilation in schools, air filters, whether the virus will get worse in the cold weather, how much a flu shot matters? Ask our medical experts. Call now at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have a great panel today. Here to discuss is Dr. Davidson Hamer, professor of infectious diseases and medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine and a professor at the Boston University School of Public Health. Welcome back, Dr. Hamer.
Thank you very much.
Also with us is Dr. Rochelle Walensky. She's the chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Massachusetts General Hospital and a professor of medicine at the Harvard Medical School. Welcome back to you as well, Dr. Walensky.
Thanks so much for having me.
And again, listeners, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dr. Hamer, what is your reaction to 200,000?
It's a little depressing, but it's not surprising given the challenges. I mean, how easy this virus is transmitted and the sort of variable implementation of control measures early in the epidemic and even in more recent months. And honestly, I think these numbers are under the real number, that there's probably a certain amount of estimates or underestimates of the total mortality associated with the virus.
So you think it's even worse, actually?
Yes.
Dr. Walensky, I'm going to play a piece of sound for you here. This is President Trump speaking to reporters in April.
I think we've done a great job. As you know, minimal numbers were going to be 100,000 people. Minimal numbers were going to be 100,000 people, and we're going to be hopefully far below that. If we didn't take quick action, you could have lost many millions of people.
So now here we are at double that minimal number, and a new estimate out of the University of Washington is predicting we could lose nearly 380,000 people from COVID-19 by the end of this year. We are at more than 20% of the COVID-19 deaths in the world, despite having less than 5% of the world's population. Why have we not been able to get a handle on this virus?
Well, I think there's been a lot of challenges in communication and a lot of tension both in politics and in that communication that has not led to a unified response. That unified response, listening to the science, listening to the data, being selfless in this somewhat selfish world right now, is really what we need to do. And in the absence of that, the virus is winning. I think, frankly, we wasted our summer. I mean, summer was the time to be outside. Summer was the time to control this. Summer was the time when respiratory viruses in general don't thrive as much. And we are now going into the fall, into cooler weather, into indoor times, at case rates that are twice what they were going into the summer. So I think we have real reason to be concerned. I wish I were surprised by 200,000. It's shocking, devastating, and tragic, but it's not surprising because we knew we were headed here with the numbers we were seeing.
Let's go straight to the phones now, 800-423-8255. Dan's on the line from Rockland. Hi, Dan. What's your question?
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. So I'm a survivor of Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is an autoimmune response triggered by a varying number of things. But so my question is, as a Guillain-Barré survivor, I'm not supposed to be taking a flu shot because it could trigger a relapse. I'm wondering if there's any science or knowledge about any eventual vaccine and if that would be something that I would also try to have to avoid, or is there any thought on that?
Who'd like to take that one?
I'm happy to take that. I mean, Dan, this is a challenge. I mean, many vaccines have Guillain-Barré syndrome associated as a very rare side effect. And I think that out of caution, most vaccine manufacturers have recommended that anybody who's had that syndrome not receive a vaccine. I suspect it may be the same for the COVID-19 vaccine when and if, well, I guess when that becomes available. But, you know, it will be interesting to see. I mean, already there's been one rare allergic type response in one of the vaccine trials. And so it's going to be very interesting to track for, you know, rare, hopefully what will be very rare events and to see if Guillain-Barré syndrome arises during the use of the vaccine. But it may mean a, you know, a future challenge for you and other survivors of that syndrome.
Dr. Walensky, let's stay on the vaccine for a minute. One of the things that we know has been going on is some preparations for vaccine distribution when that time comes. Governor Baker said last week that high-risk groups like healthcare workers, people in communities of color who have suffered disproportionately from the virus would get first access to a COVID-19 vaccine when it becomes available. I'd like to know, you know, your reaction to those priorities, and is that consistent with how we've thought about vaccine distribution for other illnesses in the past?
Yeah, it's a great question. First of all, I want to just sort of emphasize that kind of prioritization has been, you know, thought through very carefully. The Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, the National Academy of Medicine have all been working together to figure out the best way to prioritize a vaccine when it becomes available. What I want to, and one of the emphases of the National Academy of Medicine was, in fact, not just vulnerable populations because of their comorbidities, other than diseases that they may have, but of the social vulnerabilities that they have had, because, in fact, we have seen just a huge discrepancy in people who are of lower socioeconomic status, of more marginalized communities, for those with this disease. And I think, right, very appropriately, we are looking to vaccinate those communities as a priority. That said, I want to be very cautious to sort of let people know that there's a lot of those people, of any of these high-risk communities out there. So 20 million healthcare workers in the United States. So we're going to need a lot of vaccine just to sort of think about the healthcare professionals, the essential workers, those with high-risk conditions, and those in these marginalized communities before we really feel like we've had enough vaccine, you know, out there.
Before I go back to the phones, Dr. Hamer, just one follow-up question on that. A new Pew Research poll finds that 49% of U.S. adults say they definitely or probably would not get vaccinated were it available today. So that means maybe 51% definitely or probably would. Is that number enough to get us to the level of immunity we need to be at?
Ooh, that's a tough question. I mean, there's been a lot of debate. I mean, I think early on, the estimates of sort of the level that you need to have to obtain herd immunity, where there's going to be no further continued transmission of the virus, were in the order of 2/3 to 3/4. More recent estimates, at least some that I've seen, suggest it may be lower than that, but if only about half of people are willing to take the vaccine, it's going to be a challenge to reach the point where we can safely open everything and not worry about continued transmission.
All right, let's go back to the phones here. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to ask Drs. Hamer and Walensky your coronavirus questions. They're here to answer them. Marie's on the line from Billerica. Marie, what's on your mind? What's your question?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I work as a personal care assistant to a physically disabled, very fragile child. I wondered how often I should be tested.
Sure. Dr. Walensky, is that something you think you can answer for Marie?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. First of all, thank you, Marie, for the question. I would say part of this is, first of all, obviously you want to protect yourself and you want to protect your patient and for the person for whom you're caring. Part of this is really about how much risk you feel like you are taking on a day-to-day basis. If you feel like you are able to appropriately mask, that you're living with people who are appropriately masking, they're not necessarily essential workers or high risk themselves. So really this is quite a bit about how much risk you feel like you might be at. Certainly people who are living in congregant settings and in other, in nursing homes, they're sort of looking at a frequency of screening. I don't necessarily think that healthcare workers who are protecting themselves properly need to have any kind of routine screening at all, assuming that they don't believe that they're in a high-risk situation.
Thank you for that. Let's grab Katrina from Lexington. Katrina, let me just put the number out, 1-800-423-8255. What's your question, Katrina?
Hi, thank you for taking my question. So what I'm looking for is, you know, after several months of airlines, you know, beefing up their safety measures and passengers being careful, do we have any actual data on the outcome of how safe it is to fly these days? Do we see higher rates of infections among people who are flying, or any kind of data-driven insight on that would be helpful?
It's a great question. And Dr. Hamer, I think it also weighs heavily on people's minds because we are now beginning to head towards the holiday season when people will want to fly if they can or drive, but probably fly in a lot of cases to see family. So what do we know?
So this is a very good question, an important question. And a lot of us have been wondering, you know, how safe it is to fly these days. There's been a recent analysis with data from several different sort of, I'd say, exposures on flights. And you know, there's one that was worrisome. That was Air Vietnam flight where a large number of people were infected on the flight, all notably in business class where they probably had more room and more distance between individuals. But then there have been a few other suggestions that of transmission on flights, but it's relatively limited. And I think it's not no risk, but I think it's low risk if the airlines are doing all the things they've described. If there is enough space on the flights, and again, you know, if they're filling, you know, the economy class with all three seats filled and not a space in the middle, that's going to be pretty crowded. But then also it's a function of what people are doing on the flight. If everyone's wearing a mask and paying attention to hand hygiene, in particular the mask use, you know, I think the risk is going to be lower. The challenge is on a longer flight where people need to eat or drink and they have to take their masks off, because that's the time when either if they're infected, they might be exposing others, or if somebody else is infected, they might be exposed. So, you know, I think that there's evidence that limited evidence of transmission on flights overall, and the measures that are being taken are helpful, but it's not a completely safe environment.
We are taking your coronavirus calls today with Dr. Davidson Hamer and Dr. Rochelle Walensky. The number to ask your call is 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Next, we have Mario on the line from Bedford. Mario, go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. Hey, so the doctor said at the beginning of the segment that we lost the summer due to people being inside the home. But that was the government's initial response to the thing, was to do the lockdowns. Was that a counterproductive measure to the whole response? Thank you.
Dr. Walensky.
Yeah, Mario, thank you for that. Sorry, I meant to imply that we lost our summer in our inability to really control this virus nationally, and that usually if people are outside wearing masks and social distancing, that the summertime is really a time where respiratory viruses like influenza don't generally thrive. I do believe that the lockdown that we had in the springtime was essential for what we needed to do to control this. We had a massive amount of disease in our community, and our hospitals were overwhelmed. And I do think at that time we needed to shut down, lock down, and make sure that we were not contacting one another. As things have opened up, as there's been indoor dining, as there's been bars, and I don't just mean in Massachusetts, I mean across the nation, we have not been able to limit the spread during the summer, and that really would have been the time to do it.
Dr. Hamer, do you think we will see another period of lockdown here in the Commonwealth like we did last spring?
I cannot predict that, but I'm really quite concerned that this could happen. I mean, I think in Massachusetts in general, at least many parts of the state, people have been very cautious, both in terms of social distancing, public use of masks, and other measures. The challenge is that if you look at what's happening in a number of other parts of the world, Canada is seeing a surge of cases in Montreal and Quebec. Spain and France have had a big rise recently and to levels that were, you know, as bad or even worse than what they had in March and April. So they're clearly experiencing a second wave. Canada, at least parts of Canada, may be as well. And as Dr. Walensky said, you know, we're getting into the time of year where people are going to be spending more time inside. It's cooler out. You know, there's less ability to sort of, you know, diffuse the virus through natural airflow. And so the potential risk is going to increase. So I think we need to keep our guard up. If we continue to be careful, we may be fortunate and not have a second wave in Massachusetts. But if we do, then we're going to have to go into a more intensification of measures to try and control spread of the disease.
It has been a while since we've done an Ask the Doctors coronavirus call-in. You can call now at 1-800-423-8255 to ask your question. We've got Ted on the line from Dorchester. Ted, go ahead. What's your question?
Yes, I'm wondering, are we in flu season yet? And how does that influence whether or not you should have a COVID test?
That's a great question, Ted. Dr. Walensky, do you want to, or whoever just chuckled gets to grab that one.
We probably both did. I don't think we're really there yet. We are preparing for it for sure, and that means everybody should be out getting your flu vaccines in preparation for it. Typically, we see flu peak in the December, January, February timeframe, and so we want to make sure people are vaccinated so that the vaccine is working and gives you good protection by the time we have that flu season come. When flu season gets here, it's going to be tricky, especially if we have a lot of flu, and that is because coronavirus very much looks like influenza, and there certainly have been cases of people who have had both coronavirus and influenza. So it's really going to be important for people to, you know, get your flu vaccine, try and protect yourself as much as you can for at least one of these diseases. What I will say, however, in all of that, is that the same measures that protect you from coronavirus will also protect you from the flu. So we are really hoping that this year, in addition to sort of widespread flu vaccination and getting that message out, that the hand washing, the distancing, the mask wearing will protect people both from the flu as well as from coronavirus. But indeed, when you present with symptoms that look like flu or coronavirus, you may very well get tested for both.
And Dr. Walensky, just briefly before I go back to the phones, what about people who are concerned to enter into a healthcare environment to get a flu shot because they're worried about getting sick in the healthcare environment?
I will say that there have been now numerous studies that have demonstrated that we now know that mask wearing works, both in terms of transmission of healthcare workers to one another and from patients to healthcare workers and from healthcare workers to patients. So our doors are wide open. It is safe to come back. We want to see you. We want you to come back, and we certainly want you to get your flu shot.
Okay, let's take another
call.
Absolutely.
Can I just add something to that really quickly? And that is that you know, pretty much all hospitals now have a policy of providing masks to visitors, encouraging hand hygiene and other measures that are going to really minimize the risk of exposure in a healthcare setting. So I agree. You know, it's definitely safe for patients to come back.
And I have to say, I got my flu shot on Saturday and felt completely safe doing so, in and out very quickly. It's not a scary step to take, and it is an important one this year. We've got Winona on the phone from Winchester. Winona, what's your question?
Thank you. I am calling with concern that the issue by CDC that was published,
It's okay, Winona.
Aerosol spread of the virus, you know, with breathing, coughing, sneezing, what, all of those, that obviously it is a scientific fact. And the fact, and now that CDC has been inappropriately advised by the leadership of our country, that that will be withdrawn as a method of spread.
So, Winona, I'm going to help you with that, just to kind of clarify for our listeners. So at the end of last week, the CDC put up guidance referring to possible spread, airborne spread, and then removed that guidance. I believe it was the end of the day yesterday. So let's turn that to Dr. Hamer. I'm glad you raised that, Winona. That was something I was hoping we were going to talk about today. Dr. Hamer.
Yeah, no, I agree, Winona. I fully share your concerns about this. I mean, it's complex. We've learned a lot about transmission of SARS-CoV-2 over the last few months, and we now recognize that it's can be spread through aerosol. That at least there is an aerosol generated by people who are infected. And that can spread beyond just the sort of 6 feet that we've been using. Large respiratory droplets, which occur with breathing, but especially with coughing or sneezing, tend to drop down to the ground after, you know, 3 to 6 feet. But there's a lighter aerosol that can go much further. It can go several, you know, 9, 12 feet even. And I think CDC was making a comment about this. But all of these, you know, in order to prevent exposure to these, you know, mask use is really critical. I personally have great concerns about what's happening with oversight of the CDC. I mean, CDC has a lot of smart people. They put a lot of thought in their guidelines, and to post something and then to have it rescinded days later is, you know, I think inappropriate. It's almost censorship, really. And it conflicts, you know, I think their initial data, you know, are really trying to use the best available information, and there's more and more information that's been generated in recent weeks or months on aerosols and the fact that they are infective, that you can actually culture live virus from the aerosols, and there's definitely a risk. So it's unfortunate that they've had to, you know, that this has happened.
So I'm going to build on that and ask you, Dr. Walensky, okay, but if it starts to raise concerns that we can't trust the information coming from the CDC, so I guess the dot, dot, dot on that is, tell me we can still trust the information coming from the CDC and where else people should turn for reliable information other than when we get lucky enough to have the two of you on the show to answer questions.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I think I'm with Dr. Hamer in that it's just it's dejecting, actually, because I think both of us and the whole scientific community knows lifelong public servants, incredible scientists, researchers, and colleagues who live at the CDC and are doing incredible work there. And same is true for the FDA, I will say, because I know that this discussion not only speaks to the, you know, what's happening at the CDC and the public facing statements from the CDC, but also those of the FDA. I think we in the scientific community are, you know, looking to science now. We're looking to primary literature. We're looking to people who we know are the public servants who have done the scientific work, and trying to sort of separate the wheat from the chaff in terms of the messaging of it. But this is going to get tricky. I've been, you know, looking more to the NIH now than the CDC or the FDA, perhaps. But I think, you know, especially as we think about the public messaging of how this virus is transmitted, and then in the future about how vaccines, this has really been on everybody's mind, you know, when is the vaccine safe, efficacious, and ready to use, I will be looking to the scientific data rather than necessarily the statements from the FDA.
And Dr. Hamer, we have to say goodbye to you too momentarily, so I can't take any more calls, but there was one saying, if you're asymptomatic, will you always be asymptomatic? Is there like a yes or no answer you could give to that?
There's a sort of mixed answer. I mean, some people remain asymptomatic, and we think it may, you know, be age related, with younger people, you know, maintaining an asymptomatic state through their whole infection more commonly than older people. And there are probably other risk, other factors, but clearly some people, when they're tested, may be asymptomatic to begin with, and then after 1 to 4 days develop symptoms. And that's what's known as a pre-symptomatic phase of infection. And that's so not everybody stays asymptomatic.
All right, that is Dr. Davidson Hamer, Professor of Infectious Disease and Medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having us.
And Dr. Rochelle Walensky, Chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Massachusetts General Hospital. Thanks to you, too.
Thanks so much for having me.